This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss the treatment of glaucoma with ophthalmologist Dr. Natasha Dang. We'll learn about the real costs of obesity with internist Dr. Michael Aziz. We'll find out about natural strategies for bone health with wellness entrepreneur Harleen LaRoya. And lastly, we'll discover how to improve your memory and cognition with Guinness World Record holder Dave Farrell. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. A new study from the University of Nottingham has found that living through the COVID-19 pandemic may have caused people's brains to age faster, even if they were never infected by the virus. Researchers looked at brain scans from nearly 1,000 healthy adults taken before and after the pandemic. They found that people who lived through the pandemic showed signs of faster brain aging compared to those scanned only before it. These changes were more common in older adults, men, and people from disadvantaged backgrounds. Interestingly, only people who actually had COVID showed a drop in thinking abilities like mental flexibility and processing speed. This suggests that the brain aging seen in others might not affect daily function and could even be reversible. The research team believes that stress, isolation, and the disruption caused by the pandemic may have taken a toll on people's brain health. Using advanced imaging and brain age models, the team was able to estimate how old a person's brain appeared compared to their actual age. Experts say this study shows that brain health isn't only affected by illness, but also by major life events like the pandemic. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Natasha Dang in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Cataracts are the leading cause of vision loss in adults over 50. But the good news is they're highly treatable. At Oakville Laser Eye Center, patients receive advanced laser cataract surgery with personalized surgeon-led care. Using cutting-edge technology and customized treatment plans, their expert team helps patients see clearly again to help them rediscover life's details. Book your consultation today at www.oakvillelaser.ca or call 905-337-3736. Dr. Natasha Dang is the medical director of Oakville Laser Eye Center and a leading expert in laser-assisted and refractive cataract surgery. A fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons, Dr. Dang is known for combining cutting-edge technology with a deep commitment to personalized patient care. She's also a respected voice in the field, contributing to the education of her peers and advancing surgical techniques. At the forefront of vision correction, Dr. Dang leads her team with an unwavering focus on patient safety, outcomes, and experience. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Dang. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having me.
So last time we sort of discussed cataract surgery generally, but today you're going to do some myth busting, right?
You got it.
Should we get to it?
Absolutely.
So let's start at the beginning because, you know, we live in a province where, you know, a lot of the costs of surgery is covered. Fully OHIP insured cataract surgery means I won't need glasses after surgery. Is that the way it works?
First and foremost, I think it's important to know that medically necessary cataract surgery is a fully insured procedure, no matter what setting you have it in. That covers the extraction of the cloudy lens and the replacement with a clear lens implant. What's nice is that if you want to, you have the option in the same surgery to do vision correction. That's really nice because you're already kind of undergoing anesthesia, you're already undergoing surgery. Vision correction at the time of cataract surgery, from the patient perspective, doesn't add time, it doesn't add risk, it adds some complexity for the surgeon in terms of planning and positioning of the lens and so on, but it's it's something that it's an option that's available to you. If you wish to avail yourself of it, you certainly can. The primary goal of medically necessary fully insured cataract surgery is to remove the cloudy lens from your eye to improve brightness and to improve contrast. Vision correction at the time of cataract surgery is totally different. Yep. It's all about reducing dependence on spectacles following surgery.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Are all eye surgeons equal?
A lot of the discussion online, I find, tends to center around lenses or lasers and fancy technologies. Even when patients come in to see me, often I find the conversation when they're trying to choose where they're going to have surgery or who they're going to have surgery with, it's based on location, it's based on waiting list. Sometimes it's based on price shopping, like where different lenses cost and so on. I think there's a little bit of having lost the plot, maybe, yeah, as a society,
yeah,
because cataract surgery is still surgery.
Right.
We take advantage of tons of great technology. It makes it easier for us to do our job. We can do our job better. We can give you the results you want. But ultimately, the greatest determinant of what your surgical outcome is going to be is the skill and the expertise of your surgeon. From a skill standpoint, if you're having cataract surgery, you want to understand, how many surgeries does this person do? How many of those surgeries are vision correction-based cataract surgeries? How many complications do they have? What are their patients' outcomes like? Do they care about their outcomes? Do they track their outcomes? Those are the things you're looking for. You're also looking for someone who is a specialist in cataract surgery. So the eye is tiny, but there's many different subspecialties in it. If someone's focus is doing eyelids and tear duct surgery and they're sort of dabbling in cataract surgery, that's different than somebody who's doing cataract surgery multiple days a week,
of
right?
Course,
that's a,
yeah,
different skill set, right?
Yep.
It's kind of like hiring, you know, a roofer to build the roof on your home versus the handyman who built the roof once, right?
Right.
So
yep,
there's a little bit of a difference there, I'd say. And I think also there's a difference in terms of expertise. So if someone's doing like 1,000 surgeries a year and they're all focused on vision correction, that person has seen every eye shape there is. They've seen every complication. They've dealt with every lens positioning issue. They've dealt with every thing that you need to adjust after surgery. And that's kind of what you're looking for when you're trying to find a surgeon. So I guess my point here is, do your homework, be informed going into cataract surgery, but really try to find the right surgeon and the right center that's going to help you meet your goals.
What would you recommend for somebody who's looking to find an eye surgeon? How are they going to find that information?
So in terms of how to find a good surgeon, I think you can certainly talk to your referring providers and kind of see what their perspective is. I think online you can access information about your surgeons. And I think a lot of it, you can get a sense of it when you speak with your surgeon, like at the center.
What would you recommend if I'm doing a search for a surgeon? What sort of things should I be looking for? Like, will I be able to talk with a surgeon before getting the surgery?
Absolutely. In my practice, I meet with everyone who's having surgery, and we'll have that personal discussion about what you're looking for and also what you're a candidate for, what reasonable expectations are, and what we can hope to achieve. I think that's very important. I think finding a surgeon who's willing to meet with you beforehand, who's going to personally assess you, personally design your treatment plan, those are all already great indicators of success. And you should feel comfortable enough to ask your surgeon these types of questions. How many cases do you do? What are your complication rates? What are your outcomes? I think a really important question is, what happens if you do my surgery and I don't like the result from a vision correction standpoint? If I want to see something differently, are you comfortable exchanging the lens yourself? Are you comfortable doing a laser vision touch-up? And if the answer is yes, I am comfortable doing those things, and yes, I have those capabilities, and absolutely, I'll do those things for you if you need them, then that should give you the confidence that this is perhaps the right place and the right person to go ahead with.
Yeah. But I think those questions are important. You want to ask the right questions. And I think you've just told everybody what they are. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about an expectation myth. Like, is it reasonable that if somebody had OHIP covered cataract surgery, that they wouldn't need corrective glasses after, like for distance or?
In some cases, yes. The OHIP lens is a good lens. It's,
yep,
going to improve brightness. It's going to improve contrast for anybody who's got a cataract. One thing that the OHIP lens doesn't do is it doesn't correct for abnormalities in eye shape And one of the very interesting things about optics is if you leave errors or abnormalities in eye shape uncorrected, you lose a little bit in terms of the quality or the contrast of vision, but you gain depth of focus. So you will meet people who actually have a tolerance in a way. They've got a good tolerance to blur or loss of contrast, and they can enjoy that depth of focus. But something that person A likes and enjoys and views as great vision may not be meeting the expectations of person B. And I think I cannot emphasize enough how personal vision is.
Yeah.
It's like any of our senses. Taste is a good one, I think, that comes to mind. You and I might go to the same restaurant. We might order the same dish. Maybe I like it and you hate it.
Yeah.
Does it mean that the dish is objectively good or bad, right or wrong?
No, it means you have bad taste.
It could. But truthfully, you know, lenses will function differently in different eyes because every eye is unique. Every eye is connected to a different brain that's wired differently. It's a different person. We've all got different expectations. My job as a surgeon is understanding and predicting how something will function in you, communicating that to you, and trying to understand if it's going to meet your expectations.
That makes sense. All right. So let's sort of, I have a sort of like a corollary question to that. So if I don't mind wearing glasses after cataract surgery for corrective vision for distance, for example, is there a reason to have refractive surgery with a non-OHIP insured lens?
I really like watching football.
Yeah.
I'm a Patriots fan. I don't know.
Me too.
Okay, good. We can be friends.
We can admit that. That isn't a popular team right now for many reasons, but go on.
No, definitely not, especially not in Toronto, right?
Yeah. So,
but, you know, I like watching football. I used to, you know, just watch football on cable, and then 4K TV came out in HD TV channels. And it was amazing. Like, it almost felt like seeing what you would see at a game.
Right.
It was so realistic. It was almost too realistic sometimes. It was so realistic. But I found that once I'd find a channel or stream that was in high definition, it was really hard to go back to the standard stream. When I had only seen the standard feed, that was fine.
Yeah.
You don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And I think that's a differentiator between the lenses as well. So this is a common conversation I have in the clinic where people will come in and they say, you know, I've worn glasses since I was a kid. It's part of my personality. I think I look better with glasses on. Sure, if you want to keep wearing glasses, you can keep wearing glasses after surgery.
Yeah.
But there is a quality of vision difference, and I do liken it to that HD TV versus standard TV. I think that's the best way to try to understand it. From a practical standpoint, I have a lot of drivers. Like, let's say you're a transport driver, you drive professionally, you drive a lot at night. You get better contrast with some of the premium lenses, and that can be really beneficial from a night vision comfort standpoint. Pilots as well are looking for that.
Yeah.
And finally, some of these premium lenses actually work really well for and benefit most the patients who actually have compromised eye health. If you've got glaucoma, if you've got macular degeneration, if you've got diabetes, you have less contrast. Your eye is less healthy. And putting in a lens that maximizes contrast, like one of the refractive premium lenses, can really help you get the most out of your vision.
That makes sense. All right. So we promised myth busting. What are some of the more common myths that you hear when people come into your office?
One of the most common misconceptions I hear is that cataracts need to be quote unquote ripe before you have surgery.
Okay.
They're not a fruit, but that seems to be a common phrase that I hear a lot of. Often I'll meet people where they've actually been referred to me by their optometrist. Their optometrist says, look, I cannot get you to 20/20 in glasses. They've got a clear lens opacity in their eye. The lens is cloudy. They're certainly not, you know, testing well in terms of visual acuity or contrast. And I'll recommend cataract surgery. And the response will be, well, I thought I had to wait till my vision was really, really bad and my cataracts were really bad. Isn't it better to wait till that point? And I think that's a little bit of an unfortunate and sometimes even dangerous myth. First of all, if you've got a cataract and you qualify for surgery, I would consider having it because I think it's beneficial to derive the improvement in vision sooner rather than later and the improved quality of life that comes with it. I also think that waiting too long on cataract surgery can actually make it more difficult. And I think in some cases, if people wait extremely long, some of those vision correction options that you might be interested in are no longer on the table. It's not possible to achieve anymore.
Okay. My brain tells me that people are waiting because they think it's possible they have the cataract surgery and then they may need it again. Is that what they think? If they have it too early, that they'll only have to come back and do it again?
Good question. I get asked that a lot as well. Cataracts don't come back once you have surgery. Cataract surgery ideally should be a once in a lifetime deal.
Okay.
So you definitely want to put some thought into it about what you want out of it. Really try to maximize the full benefit of it and know that vision correction at the time of surgery is available to you if you want it. But certainly they do not return. The lenses that we implant are meant to last the entire length of your life. And we even sometimes do cataract surgery in babies who are born with cataracts.
Oh, wow.
And so they really can have a lens in for like 90 years.
So is it true that your eyes don't grow in size? So a baby's eyes are the same size as an adult eyes? Is that right?
Your eye will grow over time.
Oh, okay.
So in childhood, your eye actually grows quite a lot.
Okay.
And somewhere, I'd say by the age of 20 or so, on average, it'll stop growing.
So even if you're doing cataract surgery before 20, like the lens wouldn't need to be replaced as the eye grows?
That's getting more into the realm of pediatric ophthalmology, which is not my specialty. I can try to address it, but essentially with very young children, with babies, sometimes they won't implant the lens right away. They'll wait till they're a little bit older. Sometimes they do need to implant the lens more than once. My focus is more so adult ophthalmology.
Right.
So I deal with adults who've got stable eyes. But to your point, your eye doesn't grow past a certain age.
Right.
So your prescription should actually stop changing past a certain age. If your prescription is suddenly shifting or changing, especially if you're over the age of 50, that's a red flag and that's a sign that you may have a cataract.
We've covered the myths. I also know you're excited about innovations. And we covered a little bit about that the last time you were on the show. But what are some key innovations that we can take advantage of right now if we were to come to have cataract surgery?
I think in all phases of cataract surgery, I'm going to come back to football where you think about the phases of the game.
Yeah.
I think about cataract surgery the same way. So in terms of all phases, we've got preoperatively the measurements and the ways in which we test the eye.
Yep.
We use laser measurements. This has been a total game changer. It makes things so much more accurate. It lets us predict more precisely what lens is going to be the right strength and fit for your eye. In terms of how we do the surgery itself, we have the ability at our center to do laser-assisted surgery. That's one of the reasons that people come to see me, is often that's what they're looking for. That adds an element of precision to the surgery that, again, makes it more likely that we're going to attain the refractive result that somebody is looking for. We've got great lens technology. So if you're looking for very crisp distance vision, you're an astronomer, you want to see the stars, you want to see really well at night, I can give you a lens that'll do that. And you don't want to wear glasses for that, we can pull that off for you. If you are somebody who works at a computer and you really don't want to wear glasses for the computer, we can give you a lens where you don't need to wear glasses for far away or the computer. If you want to be able to see your phone without putting on a pair of glasses, we can do that too. We can give you that complete range. And then something we touched on last time, but I'll bring it up again because I think it's a really neat technology, is the light adjustable lenses. Those are very new. And these are, I find, very unique because it's the first innovation in surgery where I find the control goes from the surgeon to the patient. I'll implant the lens and then you can customize it to your liking through a series of light adjustments after surgery. There's so much we can do there.
Time for one last question. And that is, my job is relatively AI safe. Are you utilizing AI? Are you going to be replaced? What are your thoughts on this?
I don't know if surgeons will be replaced by AI.
Yeah.
We may be replaced by robots, to be honest with you.
Cool.
So robotic cataract surgery is in development and it's sort of experimentally already happening.
Wow.
I think that'll be very interesting to see. I think surgeons will still be involved in some degree because
I think
surgery is so variable and so dynamic that there will always be situations where you still need us.
Yep.
I think I'm okay from that perspective.
Fingers crossed.
AI, however, has been a great tool for us. We've talked about this before, but the way my center is set up, we see our patients and we follow them all the way from preoperatively to surgery to postoperative care, and we track the outcomes really closely. We use all of our outcome data and we feed that into an algorithm to inform our preoperative choices. And we use AI to help us do that and to consistently and continually refine and improve our results. And I think it's going to be really exciting over the next few years, maybe even year and a half, with the speed at which AI is progressing to see what we can do with it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
That was Dr. Natasha Dang. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic.
Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or skin lover's blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Michael Aziz is a board-certified internist and regenerative medicine specialist based in New York City. An expert in anti-aging medicine, he's a national speaker, prolific writer, and author of the bestseller, The Perfect 10 Diet. He's also been on the show before. Welcome back, Dr. Aziz. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me, Jamie.
So, you know, there's a lot of talk about obesity and being overweight and losing weight. Seems to be a bit of an obsession in North America. But what doesn't really get discussed is what is the actual cost of obesity, both to the countries and the cities, but also to the individuals. So I thought it'd be interesting to bring you on the show to discuss that. You up for it?
Sure, absolutely. Well, obesity is a big issue in the United States because now about 50% of all Americans are overweight and obese, and the cost is substantial. It's in the hundreds of billions, and the cost is not just for the but it's cost to healthcare. It's cost for all the issues related to obesity, whether it's diabetes, whether it's hypertension, increased risk for stroke, heart attacks, arthritis, and the list just goes on.
My understanding is that the definition of obesity is sort of, I wouldn't call it subjective, but it, you know, it isn't fixed. That researchers in Israel analyzed data recently on 44,000 adults, including 15,000 marked as overweight using existing methods. But under a new framework, they found that some almost 19% of overweight adults, or almost one in five, should have been reclassified as obese, which actually brings the obesity rate in America to over 54%. So what's your takeaway point from that? Is it that we haven't really been looking at obesity properly, or like what flows from that study from your perspective?
Well, there are multiple issues to look at obesity. One of them is BMI, or body mass index, the percentage of muscles to fat. But then that's been largely replaced now by waist circumference. I think in general, people should, if they're overweight, their height and the waist circumference should be half of their height.
Okay. All right. And is that what you use in your practice?
You can, but you know, also people know if their pants don't fit them very well, but if you only want to get medical, then you want to go by the waist circumference rather than the BMI.
No, but if somebody comes into your office in particular, like are you doing a BMI with the calipers? Are you doing that sort of thing? Or are you just simply saying, what's your waist size? What's your height? Like, what do you do?
We have a combination. We have a machine that calculates the BMI, and we also do the waist circumference.
Okay. So let's talk about perhaps the hidden costs of obesity, which I think you touched upon, right? So obesity is either a comorbidity or perhaps the cause of other conditions, which cause the economy a lot of money with, you know, the cost of medication and time away from work, et cetera, right?
Absolutely, yes. to you know, lost wages, increased insurance premium, higher prices for clothing, transportation, everything. I mean, it interfered with every aspect of a person's life.
Why did the, like, what was the purpose of the Israeli study? Like, why was it necessary to reclassify obesity? Did it speak to that?
Well, you think about it. Somebody could be 200 pounds, but they're a bodybuilder, so they have a lot of muscles. They may look like they're overweight, but they're not overweight. They have less fat and they have more muscles. And somebody could be slim, could be like just 130 pounds or 140 pounds. They think they're fit, but all their weight is really fat. So they have more fat than muscles and they're really overweight or obese.
Okay. Let's talk about what obesity does to the average person's lifespan. How does obesity impact lifespan?
Definitely, it shortens lifespan. We have the shortest lifespan in the Western world and the United States at 76. So definitely, as an overweight nation, our lifespan has been affected greatly. It's hard to determine how many years have been shaved off our lifespan by obesity, but definitely it does shave off a few years.
And does the new research out of Israel, does that tie into the shortened lifespan? Like, what's the interconnection there?
Again, when people are overweight, they have a lot of comorbidities. It's hypertension, it's diabetes. It's, you know, diabetes is almost a road for all the chronic age-related diseases. Once your sugar is high, that predisposes you to more risk for heart attack, more risk for stroke, neurodegenerative diseases. Alzheimer's disease now is type 3 diabetes, really, because it's also, they think that a very high carbohydrate diet is linked to dementia and Alzheimer's disease. So once people are overweight and their sugar goes up, then the risk for all the chronic age-related diseases goes up as well.
Okay, so if we can simply test this by measuring BMI or, you know, even using the simpler metric of height to waist circumference, then what should we be doing once we find out that we are overweight or obese? What sort of interventions do you think are appropriate?
First step is people have to identify the problem and they want to make sure that they want to be on the right path to lose weight. A lot of people are overweight, but they don't want to do anything about it. Once they are determined to lose weight because they understand the risk, they could work with their doctor and change their diet, exercise more, and even get on medications. There are a lot of medications right now that can help with weight loss. I mean, the GLP are very popular now with everybody, and I don't see a problem with it if that's a last resort.
Do you prescribe the agonists to your patients?
GLP are very popular. Everybody wants to be on it. And, you know, those peptides are really life-changing because not only they make people lose weight, but they also can prevent stroke and heart attack by 20%. So they're kind of like longevity peptides. And I think the only problem is that people really, when they take those peptides, they have to make sure that they change their lifestyle. They have to go back to a healthy diet. They cannot be eating pizza or donuts and just eating half the amount. And they also have to eat protein and they have to include anaerobic activity. They have to lift weights because anytime you use a GLP peptide or any weight loss, you can also lose muscle mass. And you don't want to do that as you get older.
Right. And that was actually going to be my next question, because if by definition, we're looking at the ratio of fat to lean muscle mass as an indicator of obesity, and these drugs actually, when you're on them, you actually lose muscle mass, then you are losing weight and you're not eating as much, but then you're not as physically able unless you actually adopt the lifestyle. And I wonder how many doctors are actually making sure that their patients are doing what's necessary, eating healthy and exercising.
I think the problem is that those drugs are prescribed everywhere. People now can buy them online, sometimes without a doctor consultation. You can just answer a few questions. How old are you? How many pounds you want to lose weight? There's no guidance on what to eat or nutrition. Many people are following wrong directions and wrong guidelines when it comes to nutrition. Many people are following low-fat diets, which are full of sugar, or low-carb, which are full of chemicals, artificial sweeteners. So that's the problem, is if you don't change your lifestyle, your diet, you're going to go back to square one once you get off those medication, GLP. Not only are you going to gain the weight back, but now you lost your muscle mass as well.
You know, I've had other guests on the show, and the issue now is that the drug manufacturers are suggesting that it is possible to change dosage or sort of micromanage the dosing such as that you can stop taking it. Like historically, you know, particularly with Ozempic,
Novo Nordisk was saying, you know, this is something that you need to take for the rest of your life. And now I'm having guests on the show saying, and they're doctors, and they're saying, well, no, maybe not. And I'm wondering whether or not sort of going on and off the drugs is actually perpetuating almost the yo-yo effect that people have when they diet and they stop dieting. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, we have no long-term data, but we know those data from diabetics who take those medications, that those medications can increase lifespan. They decrease the risk for heart attack and stroke, which is really significant. And when people lose weight, they are really motivated to get out more and be more active and have more of a social life. So I think there's a lot of positive. There's a lot of negativity about the GLP, but I think there's a lot of positivity. If you do the right things and change your lifestyle, I think they're great drugs. They are life-changing. It's really like a revolution in weight loss and in healthcare.
So I want to draw a distinction between somebody who's overweight and somebody who's obese. What are some of the collateral health problems of being overweight, but not necessarily obese, that those who are overweight may not even recognize?
Well, everybody has a few pounds to lose. A lot of people have that. And that predisposes people to prediabetes, which is high sugar. Again, when your sugar is elevated, hemoglobin A1C is over 5.6. Again, that predisposes people to early heart disease and stroke and heart attack. But when people are really obese, that's when the BMI is over 30%, then really that there's a significant risk. There was a study that showed that obesity can shave off 14 years of someone's life. You asked me about that earlier. So yeah, it can shave off when really people are obese, it can really shorten lifespan by a number of years. And now other issues happen. Now people have, you know, knee problems. They have hard time going up the, the steps, or hard time exercising. Now they may have sleep apnea. So now they're not sleeping at night. And now they're going to have issue with inflammation and so on, and all the problem of insomnia. So it's just a vicious cycle that lead to all the age-related disease that happen in old people that can happen now in young people.
Okay, we have time for one last question, and that is, what are your thoughts on sort of the normalization of being overweight in North American society, sort of like the body positive movement and those who sort of say, well, you know, BMI isn't the be-all and end-all, and you can carry extra weight and not necessarily be unhealthy. What's your take on that?
I think to accept yourself is very nice, that to have a positive attitude, but accepting that you're overweight and doing nothing about it and celebrating is a very bad thing, because that leads to the society normalizing that this is the new weight, this is how we should look like, and that's not good. That's definitely being on the wrong track for improved health and a longer lifespan.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Jamie.
That was Dr. Michael Aziz. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss natural strategies for bone health on The Tonic. I'd like to give a shout out to our longstanding sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety, including argan, rosehip, or skin lover's blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Harleen Leroy is the director of OsteoStrong Toronto and Oakville and a passionate advocate for natural science-backed aging solutions. She's the founder of Osteo October, a national campaign raising awareness about the importance of bone health, strength, and balance, especially for women over 40. Harleen is dedicated to empowering Canadians to live longer, stronger, and more independent lives through proactive, non-pharmaceutical wellness. Welcome to the show, Harleen. How are you?
I'm excellent. It's bright and sunny outside.
So, bone health. Why do you think more attention isn't paid to bone health?
The reason we don't pay much attention is because bones are very quiet, which means that as we age, there are no signs that our bone health is weakening. So none of us actually sometimes know till we've had a fracture that how are the bones doing? So there's no test for it. There is DEXA, but that's not in our regular annual checkups. And our bone health peaks at 30 and then starts declining. But none of us really, I mean, including myself till 5 years ago, we don't really know if they're really great or they have started declining faster or slower. So that's why we don't really know much about it. They're not talked about very much.
So you mentioned yourself 5 years ago. Do you want to elaborate on that? What did you find out?
I found that, so I weight train 4 or 5 times a week. I take care of my health. And all of a sudden, I felt weak. I felt more fatigue. And this was as I was nearing 50. And that's where I started learning more about it. And being a being a fitness advocate, being, you know, focusing on all areas of fitness, including cardiovascular, yoga, Pilates, gym, I couldn't believe why I was getting weak, but it was actually my bones, not my muscles. So even though I couldn't, the same weights felt heavier, I realized my foundation was getting weaker.
That's really interesting, because if you're doing resistance training, that actually assists in keeping your muscle mass up and also, you know, making it safer for your bones to be supported. Therefore, you know, they tend not to degrade. So that's very interesting to me. What are the early warning signs for weakening bones? Are there any?
There are some. Again, it varies from individual to individual. But there are people who feel like one sign is losing grip strength. So we know that grip strength is a big indicator of longevity, but it also predicts overall bone health and fall risk. Receding gums, because it may be linked to bone loss in the jaw. Poor posture or stooping, because you start to feel that. There's brittle fingernails, but that could be because of calcium or other reasons as well. But these are just little signs. They're not, you know, I would say 100% all of them apply to bone health degradation, but you can figure out, you can see some early signs. And fatigue and weakness is one of the bigger ones. It's a symptom more than a sign, where if you feel weak doing the same things that you were doing, but you don't really have any other physical illnesses, then you should look into bone health as, you know, doing a scan or DEXA scan.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I also exercise 5 times a week. And I've noticed, like, the things that I could do in my 40s, I can no longer do. And it's not that I'm not fit. I am very fit for a man in his 50s. But it catches up with all of us, right? And it becomes the question, is it this just sort of a natural aging process, or is there something wrong, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's a bit of both.
Yeah, I think that's true. Can bones rebuild themselves naturally?
That's a great question. And the answer is yes. A lot of us don't realize that bones are actually living tissue. And they can be rebuilt. In fact, they are constantly rebuilding. So there is old bone that is being, dissipated, so to call it. And there is new bone being built all the time. And the process is osteoclasts and blasts, which is happening in our body every day.
So are there lifestyle choices that we can make that can help repair our bones?
Yes, there's so many. You know, bones really are foundational, and people can argue there's multiple pillars, but the big ones are nutrition, you know, and you talked about resistance training, but I call it any kind of bone loading force, because it could come in different ways, and hormones. So a lot of our hormones play a big role in bone processing. And, this is including our sexual hormones like estrogen, testosterone, but also growth hormones in our body. These are also dictated by how our nutrition is. So it's so important for us to focus on protein for bones. Goes based on international IOF, which is the Osteoporosis Foundation internationally, they say that everybody should be having between 1 to 1.2 grams per kilogram of body weight. So in pounds, I would say it's kind of like 1.75 per pound of body weight, because that's one of the big blocks building your bone. And then there's minerals, because bones, a lot of people think of calcium and nutrition, but bones have so many minerals in there. There's, I think, 12 in terms of building our bones. So some of the things we can do in terms of lifestyle is making sure our diet is rich in all kinds of minerals and nutrition. And there are some easy, quick tips people can follow as well to make sure they're following their nutrition, taking care of their health and hormones, and incorporating a protein in a heavy way, and training. Right. So different people do different kinds of training. Mm-hmm. But for bone, one of the biggest things is that, and I think Dr. Vonda Wright talks about it quite a bit, is, you know, you need to pound your bones. She says, you know, you need the heaviest weight you can lift off the ground in order for your bones to grow. And then there is Wolf's Law from the 1800s, which is kind of like what I follow, where you need to have 4.2 times your body weight in order to impact your bones. So if you looked at power lifters or if you looked at gymnasts, they have very strong bones. Gymnasts have them because when they jump off a beam and they land, that impact creates that force. But you and I both know that gymnasts retire very early.
Yep.
Because it impacts their joints. So one of the things I notice with a lot of women I speak to is they loved resistance training. In fact, I met with somebody yesterday and they loved resistance training until they felt they got injured. And basically she felt like her trainer pushed her too hard, right? So I don't think it's the trainer pushing hard. It's just because our bodies sometimes, and all our bodies are not identical, some bodies are not built to power lift.
When you threw out a number, I think you called it Wolf's Law, where you're talking about four times body weight. What do you mean by that? You don't mean, like, so for example, I'm over 200. Does that mean I have to lift 800 pounds? Because I don't think I could do that. What do you really mean by that?
That's what it means, actually. And that's the accurate fact, where we can't do that. So power lifters do end up lifting, and it's 4.2 is an average, but like your upper body is much lower. If you look at power lifters, they do end up 500-600 pounds lifting that kind of weight. But, you know, if I was to do, I'm, you know, 135 pounds, and if I had to do four times my body weight, I can't do that.
No.
So we can pound our bones as much as we want, as much as our joints can take it. And hence, you know, again, because, you know, we have a technology which is OsteoStrong, which helps you generate that kind of force, but safely. So you're not lifting heavy weights, because lifting 4.2 times our body weight, or even three times our body weight, or double our body weight, is very hard.
Yeah. I mean, I could, you know, I don't work out at the gym anymore. I have a home gym. I used to be able to deadlift double my weight, which was significant at my age. But there's no way I could do four times.
Yeah,
I mean, me neither. I could train until the end of time. I'm never getting up to four times. So that's,
me neither.
That's very
interesting. But you could do that at my center.
Okay. So how can Canadians take control of their bone health?
Basically, it's kind of like following our conversation, prioritizing testing. So I think that would be the first thing I would really urge Canadians to do is, you know, our bone density is peaking at 30, and that's a fact biologically, and it's declining after 30, and that's a fact. So what we have to do is, you know, at least by 50, do a scan, a DEXA scan, talk to your physician, do it. At least you know a starting point, because you will know between 30 and 50 how your bones have changed. Once you know your starting point, for the rest of your life, every few years when you do this, you know how your body is changing. The problem that happens with a lot of people is, and now I've met hundreds of them that have first time had their DEXA scan after a fracture after the age of 65 or after the age of 60. So they have no idea how their body does osteoblasts and clasts and bone remodeling activity on a regular basis. And that's, you have to know, you know, homeostasis almost. And then you can start with, okay, what do I do next in order to improve this? Because once you see your starting point, you can say, we just talked about all the things, even staying at home, where you can focus on nutrition, make sure you're having enough protein. And when I say have enough protein, I mean track it. I speak to a gazillion people and they tell me, oh, I ate eggs, I ate that. And when I start documenting and I tell them to download a free app, which any of us can download, and say, track your meals, they get confused. And then they realize they were eating 40 grams of protein while they thought they were eating enough for their body.
Got it. Okay, we have time for one last quick question, and that is OsteoCtober. Can you explain what that is? You've created it.
Yes. So we have created this in order to spread the exact knowledge that we spread on this call, this talk today. Basically, we want more and more Canadians to be aware of their health, to take charge of their health, their bone health, do their scans, get tested, take preventative measures and improve longevity and basically add life to their years. And we can all prevent even the burden on our health system.
Fantastic. Do you have a website for OsteoCtober?
It will be under our OsteoStrong website. So if they go to osteostrong.ca, they'll find all the details on OsteoCtober as well.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much.
That was Harleen Laroya. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how to improve your memory and cognition on The Tonic. For over 40 years, the Big Carrot has been the community's go-to for fresh, local, and organic goodness. As a worker-owned natural food market, the Big Carrot is all about healthy living, sustainability, and bringing people together. They've got everything you need, from vibrant produce and bulk goodies to natural body care and wellness advice to keep you feeling amazing. And their kitchen and juice bars, serving up deliciousness every single day. Now, as they celebrate 41 incredible years, they're inviting everyone to join the fun. Head to thebigcarrot.ca to discover more, and follow them on Instagram at The Big Carrot for a chance to win big in their anniversary giveaways. Cataracts are the leading cause of vision loss in adults over 50, but the good news is they're highly treatable. At Oakville Laser Eye Center, patients receive advanced laser cataract surgery with personalized surgeon-led care. Using cutting-edge technology and customized treatment plans, their expert team helps patients see clearly again to help them rediscover life's details. Book your consultation today at www.oakvillelaser.ca or call 905-337-3736.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Dave Farrow is a Guinness record holder for memory and creator of the Farrow Method, a brain training system proven in a double-blend neuroscience study. He's been featured on Dr. Oz, Steve Harvey, and 2,000-plus media outlets as a leading expert in memory, focus, and cognitive wellness. Dave also runs brainhackers.com, where he shares practical brain-boosting tips, product reviews, and interviews with top minds in health and performance. Welcome to the show, Dave. How are you?
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
So, memory and cognition. I'm obsessed with cognition. I play all sorts of games all day. I do like the Times crossword puzzle and pen. I do like the electronic games daily, like Connections and Sudoku, et cetera, et cetera. It is a passion of mine. And my guess is you're kind of that kind of guy too. Is that true?
Well, I might have some bad news for you, though, because it depends on how you approach those. So the one thing that, if you remember going back a few years, Lumosity was very famous for making huge claims about how it improved people's memory and cognition and such. And then there was a large lawsuit and an equally large payout because essentially what became public was what neuroscientists know, what I've been teaching for years, is that it's only what's called novel brain training that improves your memory. And what's novel brain training? It doesn't mean reading a novel. It means something unique or different.
Yeah.
So these games that you're playing are fantastic as long as you're dabbling and jumping from game to game to game.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, people look at that and think, oh, that person's not serious. But in actuality, trying the new, it's the new thing, and learning how to play the game is actually what does the improvement for your memory. If you're good at Sudoku and you're good at crosswords, doing another Sudoku or crosswords has absolutely no benefit on your brain because your brain is just doing what it's good at. It's not being challenged to do something new.
And you kind of learn how the games work too, right? So it's less about knowledge and information. It's more about gaming the game.
Yeah, and that's what Lumosity got in trouble with. They were basically equating getting better at the game with having a better brain, and those two were actually opposite markers. The better you got at the game, anything repetitive, the less effect it has a positive benefit on your brain.
So you actually have helped thousands of people improve their memory. What does a healthy brain look like to you, and how would somebody get there?
Well, first off, a healthy brain is not perfection. Everybody forgets things from time to time. And the reason for that is more about how your brain prioritizes information. So I want to get that out of the way right away. You know, if you forget where you put your keys or you get flustered because you're stressed out, it's usually you can have a perfectly healthy brain and still be somewhat absent-minded within reason. And it's usually the result of trying to multitask, trying to hold multiple things in your head all at once. So that's the first thing, is cut yourself some slack. You'll never reach perfection. I'm not perfect, ask anybody, but it's a matter of training the brain and improving what you have. So what I teach is a form of brain training that usually refers to as a trained memory or a trained brain, as opposed to some sort of natural talent. When I was born, I had ADHD and dyslexia, still do. And I had a terrible memory. And naturally, if I didn't do anything, I would be the most forgetful person out there. And there's been times in my life where I've gotten stressed out and I go into back into my old habits and I have to stop myself and realize, oh, no, wait, I have strategies for this. So what I teach and what I recommend to people is to get into habits that improve your memory. And these are habits like studying on a regular basis, something simple like just learning a bit of a foreign language every single day, or learning a musical instrument, something that you learn something new every day is very, very powerful. Get into habits of proper sleep hygiene. That's another one. Getting enough sleep is probably one of the biggest single factors for people losing their memory. So a healthy brain is someone, to answer your question, is someone who can learn something on a regular basis at any age, 50 plus, 60 plus, you can still learn new skills. You're not set in your ways. You're not stuck. Most neuroscientists would equate a healthy brain to a flexible brain, if you want to think of it that way. So it's not a matter of being superhuman necessarily. I mean, I can teach you how to speed read. I can teach you how to memorize thousands of bits of information. All that's really cool. But the real health comes from the fact that, you know, you're in your 50s and your boss gives you some new software program to learn. Are you intimidated and unable to figure out how that app works? Or can you acquire new information? Can you make new connections? Can you still become the student and learn from the beginning? And as we get older, it's really about not being set in your ways, in my opinion.
So there's factors that cut against us. And, you know, so for example, everybody talks about stress and how it impacts your body and your GI tract, et cetera. But mm-hmm. Does stress impact cognitive performance?
Absolutely. That's a fantastic question. The biggest thing with stress is the release of cortisol. That hormone is released, and it's a survival mechanism. So that hormone, a lot of scientists believe that hormone mostly has to do with, you know, if you get injured, it'll help, you know, stem the bleeding, that sort of thing. And it seems kind of crazy because we don't get into fights where we're, you know, fighting tigers anymore, but that's our genetic history, right? Mm-hmm. So if you go back in time, we realize that our brains were getting stressed out because of real challenges, there was a real predator that was going to really, you know, eat our family or something, and we had to do something about it. So when your brain gets stressed out over something as simple as paying the rent or something that's going on in the news, you have to realize from your brain's perspective, from your genetic perspective, it thinks the world is ending. It thinks there's a tiger in the village that's going to eat my family. So it reacts accordingly. And being intelligent and having a good memory is not at the top of the priority list. It is it's dropped way down. So cortisol directly interferes with your ability to make new connections, to remember things. Probably the best way to say it is that stress is and always will be a fight or flight response, and you don't need to be smart in order to fight. In fact, it actually works against you. If you overthink in a fight, you probably won't be doing as well. So there's some belief that nature naturally makes us stupid when we're being stressed out, because, you know, the big dumb boxer, they're going to be better in a fight. And I say that as a former boxer myself. I got to tell you, it is it is really important to shut your brain off, and if you're actually in a fight. So use that lesson. Don't think that, oh, you know, stress is killing me because my body's working against me. And I realize that this is a part of your brain and a part of how your body works for a reason. It's trying to protect you. It's trying to prepare you for a stressful situation. So one of the things I try to say to people about stress, about fear as well, is all of those responses, they are an attempt by your body and your brain and your subconscious to protect you. So by reacting with anger or shame or all these emotional responses, it actually just makes the problem worse. Just realize that this is a machine that might not be reacting to the situation that the driver wants it to react to. And that alone, when you separate your brain and realize it's fallible, it's overreacting because of, you know, thousands of years of genetic history, then that alone, just understanding the mechanism tends to lower your stress and give you the ability to take control of it. And there's other things like mindfulness and such, but yeah, stress is probably the single biggest factor why people think that they are forgetful, why they think they have a terrible memory. When you look at their lifestyle, they're trying to keep four or five things in their brain all at once. They very rarely sit down and read or focus on one thing at a time, and they don't clear their mind. They don't meditate. All these things contribute to a brain that's just really easily triggered by stress.
Okay, so I think we buried the lead here. But if you're feeling overwhelmed, what's a hack that we can try? And I think I know where you're. I think I know what you're going to say. But let's see. Let's hear your answer, and I'll give you mine.
Well, you know, if you're feeling stressed, one of the first things to understand about stress is that it's your lizard brain or an inner brain that's kind of taking control because it feels like you are in danger. So the best connection I've found, and this is what I teach, is to focus on your breathing. That's now there are long-term things. If you do daily meditation, that's fantastic. Yep. If you get better sleep, that's fantastic. If you work on your relationships and have strong, supportive relationships, all of these things will contribute to a better life. But if you're in the moment, you're stressing out, you want one hack to change it, it is focus on your breathing. And that's because your lungs are that one organ that is both conscious and subconscious, autonomic and automatic. And what I mean by that is if you don't pay attention to your breathing, it'll happen anyways. You're not going to pass out, right? Mm-hmm. But if you do pay attention to it, you have 100% control over breathing in, breathing out. You can hold your breath. So it seems to be an organ that crosses both of those neural pathways, and it seems to be a way that you can take control. So there's been tons of examples of this, but the best example is that if you slow down your breathing, your heart rate automatically slows down in nearly every case, even in cases of extreme stress. So focus on your breathing, slow down your breathing, deep, slow breaths rather than quick, raspy breaths. And that's probably the best hack anyone can do.
Okay. So you gave the same answer I did. I was hopeful, and I'm glad you didn't say, and the best one to do is breathe in one nostril and breathe out the other, because that's the one breathing exercise I struggle with.
There's a lot of gimmicks with it, but again, it's the matter of your subconscious or your primal nervous system is listening to your lungs. Like if you breathe in quickly in and out, that means you're getting oxygen to get ready for a fight. If you slow that down, you're sending a direct signal to say, hey, we're not getting ready for a fight. There's nothing to be stressed out about. Just calm down so we can think.
We have time for one last quick question, and that is, what is one small change that someone can make to feel more mentally energized and focused every day?
Well, I'd have to say putting down the social media and meditating, even if it's for like 1 minute, 5 minutes. Like a lot of people who are really into meditation and mindfulness will laugh at that. Like, oh, 5 minutes doesn't do anything. But there are some people who are so addicted to social media. And I've been there from time to time. It's fun to scroll through TikTok, right? Mm-hmm. And hours can go by and you don't realize it. So take a moment every day, put it in the calendar, put it as an alarm, and shut off everything and close your eyes and go inside. We pay so much attention to our external world, and we're not closing our eyes and paying attention to the internal world. Our internal world is all messed up. And the first time you do this, you're going to get, you know, all of your insecurities, all of your stresses, all the things you've been ignoring are going to pop up, and you're going to think, this is miserable. This is terrible. But The only analogy I can say is it's like going into a room where you just have garbage all lying around. You got to go into that internal world and clean it up. You've got to address some of your fears. You've got to face your anger, your issues, anything you're worried about. And after doing just a little bit every day, it'll start to be peaceful. And then you can go there to find that calm and that peace every time, and it'll serve you for the rest of your life. But just getting into the habit of listening to the stillness, whether you want to call it meditation or mindfulness or anything, it's all kind of in the same world.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Natasha Dang, Dr. Michael Aziz, Harleen Leroya, and Dave Farrell. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin, wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.